Spirit Radio Podcasts.
So the bill that will allow for the introduction of abortion services in Ireland past all stages of the Oireachtas, and the next stages of the bill will go to President Michael D. Higgins to be signed into law. On the line to give us her thoughts on this, we have Eilish Mulroy of the Pro-Life Campaign. Eilish, good morning to you.
Morning, Wendy.
So in terms of just the latest and what happened yesterday, it was the final debate on amendments. It went on for many, many hours. Tell us a little bit about what happened.
Okay, so yesterday was the last day of the debate in the Shannon. After a week of debate, yesterday's and last Tuesday we had a 12-hour sitting. So there's been long, long hours spent. Generally speaking, before a bill can be enacted, it has to pass through both the Dáil and the Shannon. We weren't clear and we weren't sure if it would actually pass through all stages in the Shannon yesterday evening. But I think it's fair to say that the chamber, the Shannon, was probably going to continue to sit even if it hadn't been reached by 9 p.m. So what happened yesterday was it was called the report stage sitting, and a number of amendments following on from the committee stage hearings earlier in the week were debated. And unfortunately, the pro-life amendments, which, by the way, were only 17 out of the 47 amendments placed yesterday, were all rejected out of hand by the minister.
Was there any in particular, Eilish, that you were surprised were rejected?
Well, to be honest, I think a lot of people, a lot of listeners, a lot of yes voters would be surprised with the amendments that were rejected, but they were also rejected in the Dáil. Amendments like giving a woman a choice to see an ultrasound before an abortion, parental notification where a child under 16 is accessing abortion. The minister wasn't willing to countenance putting in a provision in the bill that would allow a parent to be notified before their child, their daughter under the age of 16, would have an abortion without their knowledge. I think a lot of parents would be shocked by that. The pain relief, of course, and the idea of giving a baby in a late-term abortion, pain relief was rejected out of hand again, having been rejected in the Dáil.
I think the pain relief one is certainly one that when I've chatted to people on different positions on the abortion referendum, they are shocked by this, that pain relief wouldn't be allowed at the time of an abortion is happening. What was the basis for the rejection of that amendment?
Okay, well, the first thing on pain relief is that in many countries where abortion was introduced 30, 40 years ago, they wouldn't have had the same evidence and the same scientific research about pain relief. So it mightn't have been an item for discussion when they were bringing in abortion 30, 40 years ago. The latest research shows that pain can certainly be present from 22 weeks. And the latest research suggests even as early as 18 weeks. To answer your question, the response that the minister was giving on that and on a number of the other amendments was that we will leave this up to doctors, we trust our doctors, we trust our clinicians, we're just making law, we don't want to be bettering the doctors, we want to give them, let them use their clinical judgment. He referred repeatedly to the Medical Council guidelines, protocols of the HSE, etc. The problem with that was that when it suited the agenda, I would say, the minister said we need clarity and we need clarity for doctors. So we do need to put things into the law. The argument against relying on any guidelines is that guidelines can change. The legislation can only change if the Houses of the Oireachtas elect to change it. So our argument would have been all of these things should be set out clearly in the primary legislation, not relying on a statutory body like the Medical Council or relying on other private bodies or HSE employees with the whip of a pen to change guidelines. But that would have been the basis on which he would have rejected a lot of the amendments, that he trusted doctors. And by the same token, he would have used the same argument on other topics within the bill, saying that he needed clarity for doctors. So it doesn't really wash. I think there was a general tone of there was going to be no accepting of any amendments, no matter what.
So do you feel that there wasn't kind of an appetite to, I mean, the debate was just going through the motions?
To a certain extent, yes. But what I would say is I think it was very, very important for every politician from every side who felt the bill needed to be amended to be amended to put forward those amendments and have a discussion about them and have a debate about them. Now, unfortunately, I suppose it's regrettable, the tone of the debate at times was very poor, where you basically found both Nadal and the Shannon that certainly the pro-life TDs, there was a characterization of them. There were motives were questioned. There was a talk of agendas, and everything was, the word offensive was used repeatedly. And instead of actually looking at the substance of the amendment, pro-choice colleagues and the minister were kind of mischaracterizing and misrepresenting, in our view, the motivation of the TDs who were putting forward these really humane amendments to the bill. And as you say, we've come across, even in the pro-life campaign, a lot of people who would have voted yes, who had no idea that amendments like this wouldn't have been included, who had no idea that doctors wouldn't be given true freedom of conscience. And as we know, a quantitative study of 1,000 people and a more poll back in a post-referendum showed that even yes voters supported, for example, looking after a baby if the baby survived abortion and making sure that baby got medical treatment. That was another amendment that the minister rejected out of hand. And unfortunately, a majority of both houses agreed with him on that.
I was just to ask you, in relation to, just I guess maybe it could it be argued it's a bit of a lost opportunity for those who are really pushing this legislation, TDs and senators, to have perhaps learned a little bit more about elements of it. I saw a clip of TD Kate O'Connell where she seemed to have absolutely no understanding of what the concept of perinatal hospice care is, which I looked at the Rotunda's kind of description of this, the Rotunda Hospital, and just how it's kind of holistic and being there with the family and providing the right care and lots of different supports. But she seemed to think it was some sort of incarceration of women. And it was just one of those moments where you wondered how much those who were legislating for this bill actually knew about the intricacies, but the important intricacies of some of the amendments being put forward.
You're absolutely right. And it's even worse still that many of the female TDs who purported to speak for women throughout the course of the debate, some of them were on the Oireachtas committee who looked at this issue last year, you know, were part of the Citizens Assembly process. They had plenty opportunity to educate themselves. You'll recall that Deputy Lisa Chambers called abortion regret a makey of the thing. And Kate O'Connell said that abortion survivors were fairy tales. In fact, abortion survivors had to send messages to Kate O'Connell and do videos online to explain how they actually do exist. So that was very regrettable, that there didn't seem to be an openness to educating themselves on all aspects of this legislation. And, you know, this legislation was always going to go through as a result of the Eighth Amendment.
Well, I suppose that is the overarching argument and point that has to be taken on board, and something that the minister and his colleagues repeatedly said: we're legislating for what the people asked for. I'm basically doing what the people mandated me to do, which was to legislate for abortion.
And nobody is disputing that, but the people just voted to repeal the Eighth Amendment. They did not vote for a barbaric piece of legislation that wouldn't even offer pain relief to a baby during late-term abortion, where the scientific peer-reviewed research shows that the baby will experience pain. There is nobody, or very, very few, I imagine, very, very small percentage of yes voters would even have countenance that could be the case. So there is no question that the legislation had to go forward in the sense that, you know, the Eighth Amendment was repealed, but not the legislation in the format that it went forward. It was up to the Houses of the Oireachtas to make those changes and to make it less barbaric, you know, and to do their best.
So what happens next? The bill will be signed into law by the President?
Yeah, the bill will be signed into law by the President. Normally when a bill is presented to the President, she has to sign it, you know, within 7 or 8 days. That could happen very quickly. I expect it will certainly happen before Christmas. And then, as you know, the Minister is very anxious to have abortion services rolled out in January, even though even pro-choice doctors are saying that that's not safe, that that's not possible, that can happen. But there is a real push, and that's been something that's characterised the whole of the debate, where there has been a massive push to push it through quickly. And, you know, there are safety concerns there, no matter what your position is on the substantive issue of abortion. And it's very clear from the Minister's response to the amendment, for for example, on ultrasound, that they are willing to see past these safety concerns to push the abortion legislation through.
Finally, just to ask you, Eilish, because we're running out of time here, is, you know, standing back and saying, look, the reality is the majority of people in this country voted to repeal the Eighth Amendment. There was very few TDs and senators who were willing to voice opposition to the legislation. So politically, there seems to be a huge shift there on this issue. So the question is then, what happens to the pro-life movement? Where does it go from here now that you are in the minority?
Well, first of all, we have to look at how the debate was ran over the last couple of years. If you look at things like the Roscommon Committee that sat, where they were only bringing in experts from one side, they didn't even bring in a pro-life doctor. I don't think it's fair to say that there isn't a huge amount of people in this country who believe. Well, we know there's a huge number because we have the number who voted against repeal of the Eighth Amendment. There's a huge number of doctors and practitioners who also see the real problem with neglecting the second patient. So, you know, the reality is we're entering a new phase, that's for sure. As Senator Mullen said last night in the Shannon, we're entering a new phase for the pro-life movement, but I can already see the early light of a new dawn, which was a nice way of putting it. The pro-life movement is not going anywhere. We will continue to work together towards a future where mothers and babies in Ireland are cared for and loved. And that might mean changing direction a little bit. And certainly, in the coming months, our focus will be on supporting women and looking for ways to help women and encourage women towards positive options. Because that's, from the debate and the way it's been carried out, it's certainly not a priority of the minister or the colleagues who voted in favour of the bill. There is very, very little concern. There was no discussion around positive options for women in crisis pregnancy. And that's not acceptable.
Eilish Mulroy of the Pro-Life Campaign, thank you so much for joining us on the programme this morning. When you think about your home at Christmas, what do you think about? You might think about the decorations, the tree, what you're going to be making on Christmas Day dinner, how you're going to celebrate this time of year with family and friends. And I think it's also a time of year that we look forward to seeing family and friends travelling home for Christmas. But sadly, for so many thousands of individuals and families in this country, especially children, they're going to find themselves homeless this Christmas, with no place to call home. On the line to give us an update on the homelessness crisis, we have Frances Doherty, Head of Communications from the Peter McVerry Trust. Frances, thanks for joining us on the programme.
Thanks for having me on.
Can you just give us a current update on the crisis as it stands as we head into Christmas?
Well, unfortunately, the homelessness crisis has sort of deteriorated over the past few months and years. The rate, I suppose, the official rate of increase in homelessness is sort of relatively slow, but it is going up month by month. So we're just, I suppose, officially, we're just under 10,000 people in homelessness across the country, of which just under 4,000 are children. So Ireland is probably fairly unique in that it has such a high proportion of children or young adults in homelessness. So,
To put that in perspective, Frances, that's 4,000 children who knows where they will wake up on Christmas morning. Will it be in a hotel room? Will it be on the floor of a hostel? It's really so distressing just to think about the actual reality.
Yeah. So, like, it is, like, the statistics hide the trauma that each individual and each family and child will experience. I think that people need to know that no matter how well homeless services are managed or provided, or, you know, whether they're of the highest quality or whether people are simply sort of put into hotels and B&Bs, that homelessness is traumatic, and it's especially tough at Christmas. So Peter himself would have always spoken about the challenges that single people face at Christmas. So people that find themselves in a hostel on Christmas Day, having Christmas Day dinner in a homeless service, it sort of reminds them that they don't have anywhere to go, either, you know, friends or family, that for one day of the year they couldn't sort of, you know, go somewhere else for a Christmas Day dinner, and that if you're in a homeless service, it can be, I suppose, it's almost like a reality check in where you are in your life and how things stand, and it can be incredibly tough. So that story that Peter would tell, that people would often say that they would like to go to sleep on the 1st of December and wake up on the 1st of January and just miss the entire thing because it causes them such stress and trauma. But if you think now that we have so many children uncertain of where they're going to be, you know, tomorrow night, whether they're going to be in the same hotel or B&B, whether they're going to be in the same hotel and B&B come Christmas Eve, and are they in a hotel or B&B at the minute that will remain open throughout the Christmas period. And it's I suppose, one thing to make clear, it's wrong to blame, I suppose, the hotels and B&Bs to let close over Christmas, because their businesses, they would normally close, and it's the unfortunate reality is that some of the people that they're accommodating are actually homeless, and that is their home. But
it's the government's failure to actually address this crisis adequately. It's not the fault of these individual businesses.
How do you
feel the homelessness crisis has been tackled, Francis, in 2018?
I think we've sort of seen a bit of a shift. There's real emphasis on managing the situation better. So we're not really looking to tackle it. I think 2018 was very much a year where the focus was on managing the issue, and that's not necessarily a good thing. So what we've really seen is a huge emphasis on getting families and children out of hotels and B&Bs into an alternative form for emergency accommodation, such as family hubs, which the Trust would provide a number of. We provide about 10 of those services at the moment, ranging from about 3 families in one service to about 17 families, I think, is our largest. So they are an improvement, but they are still emergency accommodation. And I suppose, unfortunately, we're seeing huge efforts go into creating more and better types of emergency accommodation rather than more and better types of social and affordable housing, which is both a preventative measure and a solution. So if we aren't really providing housing, then we're going to end up building a much larger homeless system because we're going to need more and more emergency accommodation. And the whole thing about family hubs and moving families out of hotels and B&Bs has also led to this issue around the reclassification of people in homelessness. So when I started talking, I said about, you know, that it's the official figure is 9 of homelessness is just under 10,000. And the reason we say that is because 1,606 people were removed from the official figures earlier this year. So if they hadn't have been removed for technical reasons, the true figure would be somewhere in around 11,500.
There's an effort really to try and hide the true figure. On the good news side of things, the work that Peter McVeary Trust has been doing throughout this year, and I know a lot of it's reflected in your annual report, is phenomenal. Tell us a little bit about some of the things you've achieved.
Well, I suppose fundamentally we're there to respond to a need. So what we know the solution is housing. Our sort of organisation was set up to respond to shelter needs of young people in homelessness. And while the profile of homelessness has changed, the need for homeless services has increased. So last year we would have worked with just under 5,000 people. The majority of them would be single people. We work with a relatively small number of families, but the services that we did open last year were mainly family services, so those family hubs that I spoke about. So we opened 7 new services last year, which created about 120 additional beds for adults, and then the rest of those beds, about 80, I suppose, family suites would have been created in the other 5 services for families. And then the other thing that I suppose people don't really appreciate or realise about the Trust is that by the end of last year, we were working in 8 different counties across Ireland. So we have obviously a strong presence in Dublin. We have been working in Kildare for a number of years. We have a regional office down in Limerick, and we've sort of working in Leash for a couple of years as well. So we really sort of spread out around the country.
And sadly, the need has also spread out around the country and increased in various different places. Francis, if you're sitting down with Owen Murphy and looking ahead to 2019, what would you be saying he needs to change?
I think we really need to stop people becoming homeless in the first instance. So we really need to toughen up protections for people in the rental sector. So it's still the number one source of people coming into homelessness. And it's actually leading to cases where we will help people move out of homelessness. They'll get a private rental property, and maybe 6 months later they contact us and say the landlord's selling the property and they're now at risk of homelessness again. So we really need to see a mechanism to protect tenants where the property is being sold. We need to really look at the buy-to-let investment properties that are being sold. So in recent days, we've learned that AIB are going to sell off a huge portfolio of non-performing loans. A number of those loans will be linked to buy-to-let investment departments or properties around the country. And if they're bought, the chances are that the people that will buy them will seek vacant possession or shortly sort of terminate the tenancy of those tenants. And they'll put the properties back in the market after a bit of work at a much higher rate that people can't afford. So it means that there's fewer affordable properties on the market and more tenants looking for properties at the same time. So really have to fix the rental system, and we really have to gear up and deliver much more affordable and social housing. So one of the issues we've been working on over the last few years is particularly on the area of empty homes. So there's about 30,000 empty homes in Dublin alone, and we really haven't made any real headway. So we really, like, there's an obvious solution, return empty homes to use and use this for social and affordable housing. So the Trust would have been working on this for the last few years. We've pushed this, we've argued for various measures. Some of them have been introduced, some of them haven't. But we still think there's this huge scope there to create housing quickly in areas where there's schools, shops, doctors, all the community services, everything's there. You're not trying to build new roads or new estates. You're returning an empty building that might have four or five apartments, or you're returning a boarded up house in a community that's the community will benefit, because the antisocial behaviour, the blight of a derelict property in your estate is gone, and a family or an individual or a couple has been rehoused. So the empty home story is one with...
It's scandalous, really, just the sheer numbers that are there that could have a family living in them, and as you say, could be very... And the other practical side is, if a home is boarded up, it falls into degradation and then it becomes unusable over a period of time. Frances, I know a lot of people listening will really want to support the work that the Peter McFerry Trust is doing, and you have a Christmas charity album. Tell us a little bit about the single that's been released and how people can support your work.
Yeah, so there was a group of artists that got together, and we're very fortunate in that the music community are big supporters of Peter and the Peter McFerry Trust. So they came together to put together a single and actually an album, Streetlights, and they have a single in that album called Homeward Bound, which is a well-known song, and they've covered it to raise money for Peter McFerry Trust. So you can find the details on the Streetlights Facebook page, or you can find the video for the song and the album on their YouTube channel as well, if you just type in Streetlights. And if if people want to find out ways that they can get involved or help Peter McFerry Trust at Christmas, they can give us a call on 01-823-0776, or they can email info@pmvtrust.ie, we can sort of tell them all the different activities and events that are happening over Christmas. So we've lots of collections this weekend at shopping centres, at churches, in and around Dublin and Limerick and places like that. So if you see people at carol singing for Peter McFerry Trust, or indeed sort of any charity, maybe
say hello and support them, and make sure that you support them, be as generous
as
you can.
And then finally, we would say the most important thing, if you see someone in need, someone sleeping rough, or you think is particularly vulnerable, you can also let us know, and we'll if it's in the area of one of our services, we can go out and check on the individual and make sure they're getting the appropriate supports. And if they're not, then in one of those areas, then we'll link in with the local authority and make sure that somebody goes out and checks on them, because it's a very vulnerable time for people sleeping rough as well.
Of course it is. Frances, thank you so much for joining us on the programme this morning. That's Frances Doherty from the Peter McFerry Trust. You have a bit of Christmas shopping left to do. Don't worry, that's okay. It's only the 14th of December, and a great gift that you could give to someone or someone else, I mean yourself, as you might have a bit of time to read over Christmas, is a book. And I have lots of beautiful books in front of me. Some of them have really stunning photographs. I've got a selection from Messenger Publications, and in studio to tell us just about some of the many books they have, we have Caroline Henry, who's with us in studio. Good morning, Caroline. How are you?
Morning, Wendy. Nice to be here.
For people who haven't heard about Messenger and the type of work that you focus on, tell us a little bit about your work.
Well, Messenger Publications publishes a monthly magazine, The Sacred Heart Messenger, that will be familiar to many of your listeners, the Little Red magazine. It's been going for 130 years.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's very high circulation, 55,000. It's one of the highest circulations of any publication in Ireland, which so we're delighted about that, and that keeps us busy.
It keeps going 130 years later, and you're part of the Jesuit family.
Yes, absolutely. It's a Jesuit publication. And so in recent years, we've extended our book publishing operation as well. And we have here today three of our, I suppose, statement pieces, to borrow a word from fashion, statement items, our titles from our autumn catalogue. We've got three beautiful books. Of course, it's hard to go wrong with a book, isn't it?
I know, and this one especially, the first one that we're going to look at today, Caroline, is I guess what I would describe as a coffee table book, something you can pick up, dip in and out of, that people when they visit your house will enjoy looking at as well. It's called Sharing the Wisdom of Time by Pope Francis and Friends. Wow, Pope Francis wrote a book for you.
He did. Indeed. Well, I don't know if it was for me or in particular for everybody. Yes, he kind of got an inspiration that he really wanted to bring the wisdom of elder people in our communities around the world to shine a light, to give it a little bit of prominence and bring to the attention of younger people as a source of maybe motivation and inspiration as they face their future.
And wisdom, as it says. One of the things about this book, apart from the wisdom in it, is the photography in it. Tell us a little bit about the photographer and some of the work that's in the book.
Yeah, well, the format of the book is a series of, I suppose, interviews with various people around the world, and each of those little interviews is accompanied by stunning photography. Paul Audia is a very well-known international photographer who has worked with National Geographic, among others. This was a kind of a year-long project for him, and he has produced some absolutely wonderful portraits. You can just gaze at those faces and see the character jump out of the pages. In fact, I was talking to one of the Irish contributors, Des O'Grady, a Jesuit in Milltown, and he described when Paul came to take his photograph, he spent about 3 hours.
Wow.
3 hours just. And in the end, the photograph that he did take of Des is through a window. He went outside, and you think that probably that wouldn't work so well, the skilled photographer like Paul. It's an absolute...
He's really trying to get to know a little bit of the person. It's not just kind of turning up and away you go, click, click, click,
absolutely.
And there's a photo.
Yeah.
People who kind of read some of the stories in the book, there's, and if they're kind of enthralled by it and interested in the people, there's podcasts telling the stories of the journeys that was made.
Paul himself, the photographer, found the project so interesting that he has recently produced a podcast himself. And one of the pieces is on his journey to meet a lady in Spain. And he was driving through rural Spain and didn't have much of the language, didn't have much petrol. And it was just that little, you know, journey and meeting her and then their experience together. So it made an impact on him as well. But, you know, the stories vary. It's all, I suppose, about the fact that the older person in your family, in your life, that you may come and visit occasionally, has a big backstory
and a lot of wisdom to share. Have you any particular favourites, Caroline?
Well, Des himself is a very interesting story. Des O'Grady is living with Alzheimer's. And it's, I suppose, interesting and ironic that he was the chaplain in the Dundrum Central Mental Hospital himself, and gradually came to the awareness, I suppose, during the course of his duties, that he was struggling in some parts with, you know, memory. And he has received a diagnosis, and his equanimity, his acceptance, and his living of that is truly remarkable. He's a fabulously inspirational man in a very unassuming way.
And I suppose that's one of the things about the book is it's stories from all over the world, but it's really a book for kind of all generations then.
Well, it is. I mean, some of the stories take the form of an interview with a younger person speaking with their their older maybe colleague or family member, and really that's very engaging. But it's the fact that the wisdom, the struggles, the experience, how they have transformed maybe difficult, challenging circumstances into a positive thing, how they have accepted maybe and made a rich life out of something that might have been challenging is really fabulously interesting. And some of them are funny. You know, it's a lovely book. It really is. You know, you say you pick it up and put it down. It's hard to put down. A colleague of mine, Elizabeth, said, yes, I went to browse through it the other day, and she turned page after page. She read the whole thing.
Wow. And of course, Pope Francis has a lot to say in this. He's kind of responding
he
to
responds,
a lot of stories.
Of course. He chooses, he's chosen some of the stories, and he responds. And he also contributes himself as an elder, because
he is
an elder. So it's very much his project, and it was something close to his heart as well. So, you know, what has been produced is, oh, it's fabulous. It's a testament to our older generations. It's a testament to him as Pope as well for bringing that idea and making it happen.
So that's called Sharing the Wisdom of Time. Really is a wonderful book, and I think pretty much any age would benefit from it. Just amazing stories and wisdom and photographs from around the world, as well as messages and thoughts from Pope Francis in the book as well. The next book we have is called Bright Wings, Dappled Things. So tell us a little bit about this, Caroline.
So this is a book of the poetry, combining the poetry of Gerald Manley Hopkins and the photography of Father Frank Brown, both coincidentally Jesuits in different centuries. Hopkins was a poet of the 19th century, and Father Brown will be known for his photographs of the Titanic. Among other things, he actually has a catalogue of about 46, I think, thousand.
Wow.
Yes, he was a great photographer, although it was his it was his hobby rather than his work.
But he was extremely talented.
Very talented.
What a legacy to have photographed the Titanic.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, it's an interesting story. He was on the he was given a ticket to travel on the Titanic, and in fact, his Jesuit superior sent him a telegram saying, "Get off that boat. You're not allowed." So he boarded in the UK, and he was instructed to get off the boat at Cove. And I suppose we're very glad he did.
I'm sure he was too.
So this book, it's woven together with a narrative by Joe O'Donovan, RSM, about the life and the poetry of Hopkins. And I suppose the photography of Father Brown enhances that and complements. Although they were very different people indeed, you know, Hopkins was, I suppose, more of an introvert, very tortured soul, produced fabulously beautiful poems.
And also it's a history as well when you're looking at these photos,
indeed.
You know.
And of course there's an Irish connection. Hopkins was from the UK, but spent quite a long time in Ireland. He has an association with Monaster Evan, in fact, as well, and died in Dublin. So, you know, there are interesting parallels, although they're very different, and the works complement each other very well. So again, this is a beautiful book to browse through for lovers of poetry, for lovers of photography, and for people who just like to browse through a book.
And the interesting story behind the photographs and the photographer and the many thousands that Father Francis Brown took over the years. It's great to have a selection of those. The final book you have for us today, Caroline, is called Prayerful Ireland by Helena Connolly. What's it all about?
Well, Helena Connolly is an amazing person, multi-talented girl, lady. She was a pastoral worker for many years in Killarney, and she now works with the Redemptorists. She's a singer. She's produced an album, and she has discovered a rare talent for photography. And she utilised that to combine her two interests and skills to produce this book. So it's photographs of various places of spirituality, reflection, and
places that people have prayed throughout Ireland.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got holy wells, you've got monastic sites, you've got small little detail, but you've also got big landscapes as well. It could actually be a beautiful book for the tourism market or people who are living abroad who are interested in looking at the beauty of our country. It kind of encapsulates what spirituality in Ireland, or Irish spirituality in many respects, the different facets of
and
it.
A lot of our Christian heritage as well. I'm just looking at the hermitage of St. Comal of Kilmacudda, where he lived in solitude in the landscape of the Burr. And so you're this reflection on our Christian heritage and just the many sites that so many people have prayed on over the years is quite incredible.
Absolutely. And she accompanies these photographs with reflections and some prayers and, you know, so inviting us to share that experience with her, either through the book or maybe inviting us to go and visit the places
and have a look,
themselves.
A tour around Ireland. So how can people get their hands on these books, Caroline?
Well, they're all available in bookshops, all good bookshops. But they're also it's also possible to contact Messenger Publications directly.
But the bookstores have them, which is probably the easiest way.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you've just joined me, I've been talking to Caroline Henry from Messenger Publications, who's given us three fantastic books. The first is called Sharing the Wisdom of Time. We've talked also about Bright Wings and Dapple Things and Prayerful Ireland. Caroline, thanks so much for joining us on the programme this morning. 2018 has been another busy year for film, and one of the most anticipated family films of the year is still yet to be released yet, and I know a lot of people are waiting for it. Think A Carpet Bag, An Umbrella and A Spoonful of Sugar as a hint as to what it might be. We'll be talking about that very shortly. But in studio to take a look at this year's top family-friendly films, we have film reviewer Erwin Johnston. Good morning, Erwin. How are you?
Good morning, Wendy. Delighted to be here. How are you?
So has 2018 been a good year for family film releases?
It certainly has. It has been quite a classic year, and I've certainly picked out a couple of my, what I would consider, family favourites, and some of these came out earlier. I've picked two in particular that are actually out now on DVD, so with 10 days to go to Christmas, maybe look out for those as maybe some stocking fillers,
so people can get something to watch it together as a family huddled around the fire and really, really enjoy. So one of the things that you have picked this morning, Erwin, is Peter Rabbit. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, well, Peter Rabbit, it's one of these kind of live action movies, and it features our very own Donal Gleeson, and it's based on, of course, Beatrix Potter and Peter Rabbit. So all the usual friends are there.
That's why I think it's a really good family film, because obviously the Peter Rabbit book collection are a classic, and for most families watching it, you know, adults, kids, they'll know the story.
Oh well, absolutely, and all the usual, like Flopsy, Mopsy, Cottontail, they're all there in the middle of the action. And basically the story, it's all based around Mr. McGregor's garden. Everybody will probably remember Mr. McGregor's garden. Well, suddenly, sadly, Mr. McGregor gets a heart attack, dies, and then his estate passes to his great-nephew, Thomas McGregor, who is working and in Harrods in London. And this is Donald Gleeson. So he actually takes over the estate, comes up to the Lake District and takes over the estate. So lots of adventures with his friend Peter.
And would you say, Erwin, because obviously there's some family films that you kind of, mum and dad might watch going, oh, it's good for the kids. But do you think this one entertains all ages?
It certainly does, from all generations. If you're 9 or 90 and everything in between, it's certainly a classic. And certainly there's a message there. Thomas McGregor, he wants to set up a toy store of his own, and I don't want to sort of spoil too much about it, but anyway, it all works out in the end. And basically he had a dream, and basically if you follow your dream, he thought he couldn't, but if you think you can't, you'll be right. So anyway, eventually it all works out in the end, thanks to Peter.
So there's a good message in it. Another classic, Christopher Robin.
Christopher Robin, yeah. Another one from the Disney Studios. Again, computer generation with live actors. This time Ewan McGregor, the great Scottish actor who actually featured in the biopic movie Miss Potter himself. And not only does he like Winnie the Pooh, Pooh Bear, but he's big into motorcycling, and he's an ambassador to UNICEF, and he's gone on many great adventures on his motorbike. But anyway, this story, it tells, it's Christopher Robin. He's all the usual friends are there. You've got Winnie the Pooh, you've got Tigger, Piglet, and we probably all have our favourites.
Yeah, and that's the thing, it is, it's kind of nostalgic as well. And that's the thing about these kind of modern family films is, as you say, they're CGI, so it's not cartoon, it's the actors put on these funny looking suits and they go behind a green screen. So you it's kind of realistic, isn't it?
It's so realistic, and you really feel that, you know, these characters are live, you know what I mean? Certainly. But anyway, the story goes that Christopher Robin, when he's a young boy, he's heading off to school, and then it fast forwards many years later, and Christopher Robin is an adult. He's working in a big store selling luggage, suitcases, and he's under pressure to come up with a plan. There's a lot of shortcuts required. They need to reduce the workforce by 20%. So he's in a quandary. He misses out on his family vacation to kind of consider how he can turn the company around, and who comes to the rescue but him of little brain. But I think he's a lot more than him of little brain. And anyway, between Winnie the Pooh, who comes to Christopher Robin's aid, and the company turns around, and it's a great success story.
So two that definitely will be enjoyed by all the family, and they are out on DVD, so you can watch them over the Christmas period. Peter Rabbit and Christopher Robin were probably one of the big blockbusters that's going to be released just before Christmas. They always do this, a big family movie, as everyone is perhaps clocking off for Christmas. I'm going to play a little clip and I'll give you a clue as to what it might be. You're going to get it pretty quickly after this clip, that's for sure.
Mary.
Poppins, you came back.
You seem hardly to have aged at all.
Really? One never discusses a woman's age, Michael. Would have hoped I'd taught you better. What brings you here after all this time?
Same thing that brought me the first time. I've come to look after the Banks children.
Us?
Oh, yes, you too.
There you go, a short excerpt there, a little clip from the hotly anticipated Mary Poppins. So again, it's a film that's obviously been made a few times, but always when it comes to remakes of classics, you're always kind of nervous, Erwin, aren't you? Are they going to get it right?
You're always very, very nervous, and we've waited over 50 years for this remake, Mary Poppins Returns. So after 50 years, and we've got another whole week to wait, and because it's going to be released on general release next Friday, the 21st of December. So not long to go.
I'm sure lots of families will be heading along to that. What do we know about the film so far?
Well, we know that the film is, say, 25 years. The original film was made in 1964 and 1910. So the movie has moved on now. 25 years. So Michael and Jane Banks have actually grown up in that 25 years, and the family have run into crisis yet again, and we know somebody who's going to come to the rescue, and it's that lady coming out with her umbrella and the wonderful Mary Poppins.
But, a really great cast, Meryl Streep and Emily Blunt plays Mary Poppins.
It's
amazing that you say 1964 was the last version, because, I mean, I have seen that version I don't know how many times, and it really has been a classic. I was born in the late 80s, so the question is, I wonder, will this one stand the test of time?
Well, I think it certainly will. I mean, certainly it has all the hallmarks of becoming another classic. And okay, the music will be different, but it's very aligned to the original music. You know, there will be similar style of music, I think, which is very important. And one thing I think which is very important, again, looking back at the original classic, where they had some animation included in, and which will also be the case. So I'm looking forward to seeing those dancing penguins again.
Oh, me too. It sounds like it's going to be a lovely film. That is Mary Poppins Returns. And she hasn't aged a day, as we heard. That's out next week on the 21st of December. For those of us who want to chill on the couch or when anything on TV or Netflix over the Christmas period that we can watch.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly there's a lot of the usual sort of Elf and It's a Wonderful Life and, you know, the usual ones that come out every year. But there's one thing which I think really is worth looking out for, and it's on Netflix and it's called Angela's Christmas. And it's actually out now to look at.
So tell us a little bit about Angela's Christmas then. What's it all about?
Yeah, well, what it's all about, it was actually created, again, it is an animation and created by the Brown Bag Studios here in Dublin. And, well, Ireland has such a great reputation, worldwide reputation for animation, great animation. And this is no different. And it's back, The movie is back and it's based in Limerick and in 1910, and it's based on a story by told to Frank McCourt. And Frank McCourt, of course, the Pulitzer Prize winner, who wrote about Limerick in Angela's Ashes. And this is Angela in the movie. This is Frank's mother. And it tells a story when Angela was 6 years of age. And life was really tough in Limerick. If anybody who's actually read the book or actually seen the movie Angela's Ashes, and so life was tough. And it's based around Christmas Eve. Angela, she was 6 years of age. The family went to the local St. Joseph's Church in Limerick, and you can see many of the scenes. Actually, if you look in the background, you can see John's Castle and a lot of the familiar sights in Limerick. And anyway, so Angela and the family, they go in, and there's a lot of great empathy with Angela for the baby Jesus in the crib. It's cold and it's damp. And in the movie, it says, if you haven't got a cough going into the church, you definitely will have one coming out. And she feels empathy for the baby Jesus in the crib. And she goes along when backs are turned, and she takes the baby Jesus out back to their home so that the baby Jesus actually could be warm.
Well, sounds like it's going to be a heartwarming one. That's on Netflix. Remind us of what it's called again, Erwin.
It's called Angela's Christmas, and it's on Netflix.
And great that it's Irish as well. Fantastic. I've been chatting to film reviewer Erwin Johnston about some family-friendly films. If you've just joined us, out on DVD now is Christopher Robin and Peter Rabbit. On the 21st of December, Mary Poppins Returns hit cinemas, and Angela's Christmas is on Netflix as well. So lots to be going on with and to be enjoying over the Christmas period. Erwin, thanks for joining us on Spirit Radio this morning.
You're more than welcome.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.